In every war, there is a battle to end all battles. We are the Spy-Fi Guys, and this is Midway. Welcome to Spy-Fi Guys, where we cover spy facts, spy fiction, and everything in between. I'm Christian.
And I'm Zach.
And we are covering this week 1976's Midway.
Christian, is that a spy movie?
I mean, okay, you know what? You know how we love to stretch it, but there is actual real-world intelligence that happens in this movie.
Yes, that's correct. So for those of you who are first tuning into the Spy-Fi Guys, we expand our horizons frequently on this podcast, I would say, to movies that include military intelligence movies, those you don't traditionally think of as spy movies. And we've covered quite a few old World War II movies, old and new. So this week, we are bringing on our World War II expert, ZJ.
Hello, pleasure to be here again.
This will be part of a duology, although it'll be separated by a month, because to keep with our usual format. But we're going to be doing this Midway from 1976, and ZJ is returning in about 2 months' time to talk about Midway 2019. That's the year I think it came out.
And, you know, I gotta say, when I was watching this movie, it did occur to me this one could benefit from a remake.
Yes.
There's not a lot of movies that fills the criteria, but this one, yeah.
You know, we'll save that discussion for another time, Zach, of many movies that either do or do not need a remake. Because mm-hmm. I'm sure we could talk hours and hours about that. But I've actually seen the 2019 Midway before on a plane, so I was only half really paying attention. So I had the bare bones idea of what happened in this, you know, other than, you know, shockingly, I feel like I'd even living in Hawaii and Midway being not that far, we don't really learn the history, that much of the history of Midway in like school.
So I guess I'll ask, have you guys seen this movie before?
I had not.
I don't believe I had.
Believe I've seen parts of it. The only part that I remembered was Charlton Heston crashing at the end.
Ah, spoilers. Going into full spoilers here.
That's right. Here on the Spy-Fi Guys, it's just full spoilers all the time.
Huh, interesting. Also, it took me a while to clock that was Charlton Heston. I don't know why. Yeah, I should have realized that was him from his look, but also his manner of speaking, but it just didn't clock to me.
Oh my god, just such a generic white guy amongst cameo. But yeah, it took me a while to realize, because there's other famous actors too, like Robert Mitchum, Henry Fonda. Mm-hmm. It's going to be hard to pick them apart.
So, setting aside the movie, how much did both of you know about the history of Midway itself?
I guess I'd say a fair amount. Actually, U.S. Navy maintains a great website on the Battle of Midway with a lot of first-person accounts and kind of detailed analysis. So that was something I'd read before, and additionally, I'd seen the hit documentary, The Battle of Midway, which is actually fantastic, and I would strongly recommend it if you wanted to watch a World War II era propaganda film about the Battle of Midway.
That actually does sound interesting. How long is it?
Ooh, I believe just 20 minutes.
Oh, then perfect. I was like, if you were going to say like an hour and a half, like, I could almost do an hour. Like 20 minutes. Yeah, no, I think I'd be interested in that. That'd be very curious.
Yeah, it goes over some of the same things. It has perhaps no one in the U.S. had as good an idea of what had happened at that point. it's a very rosy interpretation of the events of the battle. So
they probably knew what they were doing the whole time.
But it is actual documentary footage, and for the most part, that footage is from the Battle of Midway. So that's cool. Kind of cool resource if anyone wants to check out, you know, some footage from the actual battle.
Zach, what about you? What did you know about Midway?
So the only thing I knew was that a bunch of bombers were flying around, and then they spotted the carriers basically on lock, and then bombed it, and then that's how the U.S. won the war.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so. Now, I know I said I didn't learn about it in school, but actually, thinking back now, I have actually learned a bit about the Battle of Midway, especially from an intelligence perspective, because at the National Cryptologic Museum, I'm going to say about a year ago, they did a nice refurb of it. They have a really good exhibit about Midway and about the intelligence aspects of Midway. So yeah. I think maybe after, well, depending on what our schedules are, but maybe after this, you know, we finish up this duology, we should go over there and take a look at it and see, you know, what's what actual real, beyond what our research says, what does, you know, the NSA's museum say about it?
Okay.
All right. So shall we get into this? Zach, do you have our synopses?
Yes, I do. So as always, we have our poetry synopses. I will be, and I know we've already done one spoiler, the big one, but spoilers continue. So here we go. So here's the haiku. Yamamoto's plan. What the hell is happening? Tom crashes and burns.
I believe it's Matt.
They both crash and burn.
That's true. Well, no, well, yeah. Well, true. Oh, yeah, I guess they do. Well, yeah, but I'd say Tom burns and crashes. Matt crashes and burns.
I think that's a great distinction.
Yeah, I was going back and forth on which one to pick.
All right. But bravo, bravo. I like that.
Thank you. And then here is the limerick. This is the story of Strawberry Five, who away from the Jays they did dive, broke through the cloud barrier and spotted a carrier so their friends back at home would survive.
Pretty good. Oh.
I like
it. Interesting use of J's as opposed to any other
phrase. Syllables. And then here is the real IMDb plot summary. A dramatization of the battle that was widely heralded as a turning point of the Pacific theater of World War II.
Cool. So let's get into our plot. So we start with a giant block of text that I've read and and subsequently like forgot. It literally went in my eyeballs and then out. I was like, this is too much reading.
Do you guys watch the movie today like you usually do?
What's that?
Do you guys watch the movie like right before we started?
I started it maybe last week and then I finished it last night. So it's fairly fresh in my mind.
Yeah. I didn't finish it right before this. I finished it about 20 minutes.
But yeah, it reminded me of the Flash Gordon rolling text that was George Lucas's inspiration for Star Wars. But it says there's actual footage.
That's the one thing I got of it. It says it's footage of, you know, planes in combat. Doesn't mean that it's from the Battle of Midway.
So it's actually, I could speak to that a bit because I recognized a lot of the footage. It's as far as I can tell, it has essentially no footage from the Battle of Midway. Interestingly enough, if you look very carefully, you can spot footage from, I believe, from Tora Tora Tora.
Really?
Yes. I've picked out a couple of points when there's very clearly footage from. Well, there's footage from that film. There's footage from a couple of other films. It looked like as well, including, and this actually was some of the best footage that we saw in there. A Japanese war movie from I believe the 50s or 60s. Wow. I don't recall, but
yeah, they're just stealing from everybody.
But yeah, they did a great job with their sets, unlike Tora Tora Tora.
All right.
But yes, there was a lot of footage from World War II that was spliced in. It wasn't from the Battle of Midway. Most of the planes were either anachronistic or not from the correct side.
That's bad.
Yes, ditto the ships. But there was actual war footage spliced in amongst this also footage from other films. Interestingly, the opening shot that we see with the B-25s taking off for the Doolittle raid, that was from a World War II era film in the U.S. called 30 Seconds Over Tokyo.
I've heard of that film.
Which also starred Robert Mitchum.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, speaking of Robert Mitchum, a few other famous names from the cast, besides those we've discussed already, Tom Selleck.
I did not spot him.
Where was he? Yeah.
He didn't have his mustache, I think. On IMDb, he's like some general's aide.
Yeah, I saw that. I did recognize Glenn Ford, a.k.a. both, you know, Jonathan Kent from Superman the movie, and also Perry White from Lois and Clark.
There you go. And then what about John Williams for the music?
I did recognize that.
I'm looking through Wikipedia, though, so apparently James Coburn's here somewhere. Actually, I think I spotted him. Robert Wagner's in here somewhere, number two himself.
Mm-hmm.
Eric Estrada's in here somewhere? What?
the old war movies, they got everybody.
Wow.
Another big name, of course, was Toshiro Mifune as Admiral Yamamoto.
Which made me realize, I don't think I've actually ever seen him in a film before, because I've not seen a lot of
Kurosawa
films. I don't think I've seen, I may have seen clips of some, but not entirety. Also, other famous on that Japanese side, Pat Morita, Mr. Miyagi himself, is in there.
That's right. I saw that.
Yes, a lot of famous names here. But yeah, so we start off with the Doolittle raid, and they're like, don't explain what's going on. So I'm like, oh, I mean, I guess I have the advantage of having watched, you know, Pearl Harbor and knowing, you know, learning about the Doolittle. Hey, that's how I learned about the Doolittle raid. That movie did something.
Yeah, ZJ, that's how Pearl Harbor starts Act 3, is with the Doolittle raid.
Have you never seen Pearl Harbor?
Was that Ben Affleck?
Yeah.
No.
It's not as bad as people say.
I believe it.
You know, next time you're in town, I kind of want to see your reaction to it.
Sounds like fun. I enjoyed Red Tails, so it's not like war movies are totally outside my wheelhouse. Yeah. So.
Okay, all right. Well, we'll talk more about campy war movies in 2 months.
For the next couple hours, I think.
Also, yes. But yeah, so that's how I learned about the Doolittle raid. But it was interesting that they now explain it. I was like, okay, 1976. That you are what 30 years removed from the actual events of that time. Do people still just know what the Doolittle raid is?
Well, they go on to explain it.
They do later, but I was just like, it was like, it's a bold move to start off your movie and not explain what's going on. Just, oh, it's, you know, the fact that it's army planes taken off from Navy ships, and that's a cool thing.
Well, not explaining what's going on? It's almost like that's a recurring problem.
Well, that's interesting, because it might be, so let's see, 30, let's say 35 years before the film came out. What was 35 years previous to today? 1989? So if you showed shots of, like, the Berlin Wall falling, you wouldn't necessarily need to say, oh, the Berlin Wall's falling.
Yeah, you would, CJ. Kids these days don't know anything.
But you're not necessarily making the film for kids.
That's true.
Every movie these days is made for kids.
Parents that bring their kids to the movie can say, hey, kids, let me explain this to you.
That's an interesting...
This was the Doolittle raid.
Whether, you know... Well, but is the Doolittle raid on the same scale as the Berlin Wall falling? I don't know that it is.
I'd say it might be. It was a very major moment for U.S. propaganda.
Fair enough. I guess, yeah, because obviously I didn't grow up in that era, so I don't know what the actual impact of that was, how many people knew about it. So,
it's a very good question, and I don't actually know the answer, of course, but yeah.
We next go to Hiroshima, where we meet Admiral Yamamoto, who is told about the bombs that hit over Tokyo, and that these bombs proved him correct.
So I like right away, the movie establishes itself that it was made in 1976 because it has this aide in a spiffy uniform. And he's like, I have a message for Yamamoto. And he slowly walks through this bomb. And he slowly walks up to the door.
Hey, those old movies took their time. They had the time to, tell a story.
Fortunately, the whole movie is not like that. But yeah, it's like, oof. Oof.
Thank goodness this one wasn't 3 hours long.
I was a little worried. These older movies, especially war movies, where, and I'll talk more about it, when it started to remind me of Toro 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 and The Longest Day, I was worried it was going to be a 3 hour thing. But yeah, what was it, like 2:15 or something like that?
It was perfectly good. Perfectly good.
Wow, actually, 1:31, so like 2:10. Yeah, 2:11. We go over to Pearl Harbor, where they finally do explain the raid, the Doolittle raid, and what happened with it. I think you hear it over like a radio broadcast.
And actually, I wanted to comment briefly on the radio broadcast.
Sure, go ahead.
You might have noticed a very distinctive voice, kind of like strange accents, pronouncing certain words oddly. That is meant to be the voice of H.V. Kaltenborn, who was a military news analyst for NBC during World War II. And the voice probably would have been recognizable to people who lived through the era.
Interesting. Wow. So was it actually him, or was it someone mimicking his voice and accent?
I think that it was someone mimicking his voice and accent and saying exactly what they wanted to be said.
Okay. But also, I was like, this seems like, so Zach, I don't think you've ever been to Hawaii before, have you?
No, but I'd like
DJ,
to.
DJ, have you been?
Yes, actually. My brother currently lives on Maui. I've been to Maui and the Big Island.
Oh, but you haven't been to Oahu?
No, I only flown through.
Okay. So on Oahu, there's a place called Kualoa Ranch, which is this beautiful, beautiful place. It's where the big scene of the whatever that dinosaur is that's running in Jurassic Park, where they jump over that log.
Okay, I see. It's kind of in the beginning when they first spot them but aren't in danger.
Yes, yes. And then they have to, like, they run and they, like, jump over a log to, like, get out of the way of them. So that's all filmed in Kualoa Ranch. But also, it was a big site during the war. And they have, like, well, one, they filmed a lot of other movies, including war movies. Actually, the whole of Windtalkers, almost all of it was filmed there. But they also have, like, these bunkers that look very much like where they go into when they're, like, talking about the raid and when they're going to visit the intel guy, Joe. What's his face? Rochefort?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
So anyways, like, I was like, as I'm watching this with my wife, we're like, that looks, I don't think it is there because it's on the wrong side of the island, but it's something very similar to the one they have over at Kualoa.
Yeah. I believe that the movie was filmed in San Diego, San Diego Navy Yard. So it kind of looks Hawaii-ish because it's got palm trees, but it's not, like, also not Hawaii, right? It doesn't have the mountains. It doesn't have. And I believe a lot of the filming of the ships was done in the Gulf of Mexico, which.
That is correct. From
I can't identify water just as water, so I didn't notice. But.
You're slipping up, DJ.
Technically, the scenes which were filmed furthest from where they occurred.
Interesting. Well,
maybe not actually. Yeah. Maybe Florida is. But
we're following Captain Matt Garth, who's got two first names.
He's played by Charlton Heston. Yeah.
Yeah. Is he? He's not based on a real character, a real person, is he?
He is not. It's a good day again.
His role kind of takes on some of the parts that a different intelligence officer would have had, but no, he's.
Okay.
He's an intelligence officer who's also a fighter pilot who's also
So he's a Mark Wahlberg's guy from Patriot, basically. You know, somehow is at everything. Yeah. He goes into a bunker, talks with, you know, a naval intelligence guy, Joe Rochefort,
yeah, I think.
Yeah. And Joe thinks that Coral Sea will be the next place that they hit. Apparently they've got about 10% of one of the codes, I don't remember which one, deciphered. And there's been an increase in radio traffic. They see mentions of this plan called AF, but they're not sure what it is yet.
I think it's a location called AF.
That's what it was, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and they're not certain. But so, they know where the next attack is going to be, and it's going to be Coral Sea.
So I quite like how they establish the stakes. Like, the U.S. is on the back foot. The Japanese are on the move. If they mess up here, it's, like, totally over. And I thought that was very interesting and scary.
Mm-hmm. So,
this beginning is quite good, even though it did remind me of Tora, Tora, Tora.
Yeah.
Yeah, they did a better job of establishing the stakes. It does seem like that.
So, at this point, when Captain Garth's son Tom arrives, I actually did think that at least when watching it, I thought it was filmed on Ford Island and, like, where Pearl Harbor is. Because it looks quite similar to that, but apparently not. So I was like, oh, wow, they did a good job fooling me, at least at that part.
I don't think the Navy's very creative with their base design.
That's the other thing. It was like, oh, it's probably, like, especially of that era, they probably all look the same.
Wow, they got a real Quonset hut.
I also liked how when the dad and son meet each other, they shake hands.
Yeah, yeah. It's a very, very formal family.
Well, very, like, old school masculinity, yeah.
Well, I think it's also to establish that they haven't. They're practically strangers at this point. He says, "Hi, Dad. It's been a great, you know, wow. You've grown up a lot in the last 3 years," is what his dad says. So
3 years, jeez. Well, there's also been a war going. Well, actually, so what's our timeline? How long? This is what, 6-ish?
42. So it would have been 6-ish months.
Okay. Yeah. All right, so no, the war has not been going on for 3 years.
No.
So he's just a terrible father.
Yeah, well, it sounds like he got divorced and
that's right.
Went on to his Navy career. And
yeah, you know. Military man, lifer. Yeah.
So Tom has been assigned to Kaneohe, which is a different part of the island. And then we go to a tiki bar. To, you know, you've got to make it seem like Hawaii somehow.
Do what you can. This was very interesting. This reveal that he loves a Japanese American woman. I was not expecting this in the movie.
Hmm.
Considering all the other war movies we've seen, all the characters are like, yes, I will go and fight, and I have no personality.
Can I argue that?
You can push back on it. Really. We have a friend who shall remain nameless who hates war movies, war TV shows, because all they do in every scene is just talk about the war. It's just all war all the time. It's a bit of an exaggeration, but it's not totally wrong. It's like 90% of conversations are something war related. So whenever you see one that's not, it's interesting. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, yeah. So I think I'd say that I was going to say that it's more of a modern war film in that way, because the modern war films always seem to have, you know, a love interest or something going on. I'm thinking of Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
But I realized that actually old school movies were always like that.
I was going to say, like, From Here to Eternity is a classic war movie that.
Yeah. Or Dive Bomber or, you know, any of those old films.
Which... You have to get something to get women to come and see the movie.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
I think that probably was some of the motivation back then. They're probably like, women want to see these other things, so we'll put them in the movie, and
that's right.
You know, that'll be interesting.
Just, you know, the cross-culture romance, and especially with the, you know, that climate and the fact that apparently she's been the girl has been arrested, and that the FBI has intel on her folks.
Is great. It's interesting.
But yeah, so of course Captain McGarth is suspicious about this. We find out that her name is Haruko Sakura, and that she's going to be sent back to the mainland because of all this going on. So Captain Garth says he's going to try to get her file to at least look into this.
Yep.
And they met at, what is it, UC San Diego or something?
Yeah, he said that.
Yeah, that's right. Because I was like, yeah, how did you know, you just got here. And you're already in trouble with the girl you're in love with who's been arrested. How'd that work?
Yeah.
And probably they travel in different circles, too.
All right, so we go to Hiroshima Bay, where it's the battleship Yamato.
It's not.
Okay.
I think that this might actually, because it looks like the Nagato. And the Nagato is the flagship for the attack on Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
And I think that this might have been a relic from the film from Tora Tora Tora.
At least they got the country right.
Yeah, we'll have more of that later.
Yeah. But we do see that, yeah, this is supposed to be Yamamoto's flagship. There's discussion about what their plan is for Midway. They can't land on Midway unless the forces on the shore are taken out. But unlike Pearl Harbor, this is not a surprise attack, you know, with a couple of ships. This is a much larger and more complex operation.
It's something that we see in these war movies a lot, where everything has to go perfectly for it to go correctly, which is kind of like a bridge too far the last time we had PBA on.
Right.
I think that with this one too, there's a lot of moving parts, but actually some of the other moving parts aren't, like the attack on the Aleutians. It's meant to draw away Nimitz. It's not actually essential to the plan in a way.
You don't think so? I feel like it was, because they said if the carriers were there, they could just pick us off from like a distance and we never even get close. Right. Or am I thinking of a different part?
I think I don't recall exactly, but I think that might have been later in the film when they no longer have any aircraft carriers.
Okay.
I could be wrong, though. You might be right, Zach. And yeah, I also don't know if this is clear, but one of the main part of the fleet that's, I think, meant to engage the American fleet. The assumption is the Americans will send also their battleships, I think. And then the Japanese battleships could engage the U.S. battleships as well. Yamamoto himself is in charge of all the battleship forces, which end up being totally irrelevant to the entire battle.
Funny that.
an interesting fact I read is that this operation from the Japanese side used as much fuel as the entire first 6 months of the war.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, I think somebody says like this is their only chance to lure out the Americans. If they don't do it, the Americans will just build up a huge fleet and totally take them out. So it's like high stakes for Americans, but also high stakes for the other guys, too.
Yeah.
So that's really interesting.
Yeah, so we also hear that their next operation that's underway is the Coral Sea operation, which is starting soon. So that proves Rochefort right. And so the Japanese command agrees to meet again after that campaign is over.
Mm-hmm. There's a part where they show American like naval bases getting ready for attack. And again, they have the World War One helmets. Long-time listeners may remember Tora, Tora, Tora. They had the World War One era helmets too. And I pointed that out. And ZJ said it was accurate.
Yep. In early World War II, they were still using the Brody helmet. They hadn't switched over.
Right. We hear that the Battle of Coral Sea was, you know, inconclusive. The Yorktown got the, you know, the crap beat out of it, which I'm going to go back to Pearl Harbor because this line always stuck with me from the end of Pearl Harbor from what's her face?
Evelyn.
Yeah. She says the Doolittle raid was the pivotal moment of America's war with Japan. Before it, America knew nothing but defeat. After it, nothing but victory. Except Coral Sea was inconclusive. So that's wrong, Evelyn. You're wrong.
And it ignores all the naval combats off Guadalcanal.
Right.
The U.S. did not exactly cover itself in glory.
Yeah. So I was like, I know you're trying to make a point at the end of Pearl Harbor. And actually, you know what? Again, kudos to them for featuring the Doolittle raid. But that's just wrong. That is wrong, Michael Bay. After Battle of Coral Sea, we go back to Rochefort, who is trying to figure... He was pretty sure that AF is Midway, and he uses a pretty simple ruse to confirm that it's Midway. I like this, though.
I mean, it's spy stuff, right? That's what we're here for.
Mm-hmm.
Tells Midway to, you know, transmit in the clear, uncoded, that, what is it, one of their compressors?
Yes,
their water purifier.
Purifier, thank you, is down. And then, you know, they send it, the Japanese intercept that, and they transmit that back to Tokyo, encoded, which Rochefort can read, mm-hmm. that AF's water purifier is down. So that's conclusive that AF is Midway.
There you go, got him.
So now that they know the location of the attack, Admiral Nimitz and his staff work to get the carriers of the Enterprise, the Hornet, and the Yorktown, which has been really, really hastily, you know, repaired.
Which is cool.
All the way to a point which they select, which is north of Midway, waiting for the Japanese fleet. And I know it covered a lot of stuff right there, but I was like, there's a lot. I'm just going to condense that. Do we need to talk about what's-his-face's skin disease? Do we need to talk about
So I would say, I don't know about the skin disease, except it is Robert Mitchum's only part. Apparently, he only agreed to be in the movie if he could be in bed the entire time.
I feel like we talked about Halsey when we did Tora, Tora, Tora.
Yeah, I think so. I think that that's what it was, is that they made sure to shoehorn Halsey into Tora, Tora, Tora.
That's what it was.
As a main character, because he featured prominently in a lot of the U.S., you know, U.S.'s later victories.
Yeah, that's right. I do remember this. I know this name, but why do I remember this name?
It's a like a celebrity cameo. By the way, something I recently learned is that Halsey said, by the time we're through with them, the only place they speak Japanese will be in hell.
Wow.
Kind of unfortunate.
Oh, man.
I was waiting to see he was going to say it in the movie, and he did not. Unfortunate.
I did want to highlight, though, maybe less the skin disease.
Yeah.
And more so the various decoding efforts, but also because I think that this is the part that's really spy-like, but also and I think that this is also a key feature of spy and, you know, military intelligence, is convincing the higher-ups that that's what's actually going to happen.
Yes, that is, and I don't want to talk too much about Pearl Harbor, but there is one line in Pearl Harbor that makes the movie, and it is about intelligence, but I will save it for whenever we get together next and we'll watch that movie.
Okay. Well, in this context, I think basically every military... So the Nimitz has his code breakers,
mm-hmm.
who are telling him stuff and his intelligence team. And Admiral King back in Washington has his intelligence team that's telling him stuff. And those two intelligence teams did not agree on what was going to happen. And that's what's depicted in the movie, is that competition kind of between basically the different intelligence teams trying to convince their bosses what's going to happen and why do we know that. So
interesting.
And the intelligence team of Nimitz's was spot on here. So.
Yeah, but a good thing they got listened to. It's, again, it's like, look how close it is.
Yeah, and an interesting thing, too, that goes even beyond that is that Admiral MacArthur, who is currently in Australia, had his own intelligence team.
Yeah.
And the British over in the, I guess, the western side of the Indian Ocean had their own intelligence teams. And the British were convinced that the Japanese were going to attack Madagascar, which at the time, the British were occupying Vichy French Madagascar, and it wasn't going great. So it wasn't without reason that the Japanese could have gone over there. So the British saw the threat next to them. MacArthur thought that they were going to attack Australia, where he was. What's his name? King and his people thought that they were going to attack possibly the U.S. West Coast. And right. Nimitz, of course, thought that they were going to attack Midway. So there was a lot of competing ideas about what the enemy's doing. And when you can't see what they're doing, they're, you know, 10 feet tall and doing everything at the same time. So.
Yep, yep. And I did like which commander or admiral was it who was like, I'll put us north of Midway where basically, you know, we can defend Midway, but also if they do actually make a break for the West Coast, we can cut them off.
I guess two notes on that. This is actually one of my fact versus fictions, is kind of the line in the movie versus what was reportedly told to Nimitz in real life about the intelligence. Yeah. And then the other is just noting the fact that the U.S. still had all, I think it was 7 of their slow battleships covering the West Coast.
Yeah.
So the U.S. West Coast is not undefended.
Like, yeah, like the way they make it sound was like, all right, it is these 3 battleships that is all that's defending the West Coast.
Yep. Yeah, there's slightly more. And the
these 3 carriers, excuse
yeah.
me. Yeah.
Yeah. The battleships only go roughly 2/3 the speed of the aircraft carriers. So they would be way too slow to keep up with any of these movements that the aircraft carriers are doing in battle.
And they don't
so
have
they just,
planes either.
Yeah, so they just left them because they would have been a hindrance, not a help. But then the fact versus fiction, and I don't know if you want me to save this for later.
Yeah, go for it. We're here. Well, let's talk about it.
Sure. So I think that the line in the movie is, we're assuming they'll attack from the northwest, but there's no intelligence to support that.
Mm-hmm.
And the spy fact is that Layton, who's kind of the closest analog to him in the movie would be Charlton Heston's character. He's written out of it, despite being a major player. Oh. Anyway, Layton tells Nimitz they'll come in from the northwest on a bearing 325 degrees, and they will be sighted about 175 miles from Midway, and the time will be about 6 a.m. Midway time. So, not a ton of ambiguity in the prediction.
Yeah, that is quite on the nose there, yeah.
And that actually leads into kind of, I think, the very next scene, or maybe where they finally spot Strawberry 5, spots this force. And Nimitz says in the movie, for seemingly no reason, says this is not the main body, but in actual fact, mm-hmm. he was referring to the fact that they knew where the Japanese would be coming in from. And he was just reminding Spruance, don't go after this force because there's going to be another one. So
it
wasn't just a hunch that he was ordering them not to attack a Japanese force because of a hunch. It was due to the specific intelligence that they had about the Japanese actions and disposition. They knew that this other force would be coming in for the invasion.
There you go.
Well, before we get to Strawberry 5, we got a little bit other stuff to cover. We've got on the Yorktown, there's a really cool transition where they're walking around and they get on one of the lifts that is for the planes. And so it looks like the entire ship is moving around them, but they're just going down the elevator.
That's a great part. That was really cool.
That was a cool shot there. Like, all right, you are using your environment for that.
Do you guys like the part where one of the admirals looks at a pinup girl?
I missed that.
Did he?
Part? It was so weird.
Was he in a file?
Yeah.
Like, that was because that was the girl. That was the girl his son was dating.
Oh.
It was in her file.
I thought he was just looking at random pornography in his office.
No, it was Charlton Heston was looking at his son's girlfriend's Haruko. File.
Yeah.
Yes, Haruko's file.
Oh, interesting.
But I had the same thought for a second, Zach, and I was like, what is going on there? But no, it was, I realized, because then he focuses on it in the next scene after.
Or Captain Garth goes to see Haruko and meets her parents and talks with her. And we find out that Haruko has refused to see Tom, but he convinces her. So when Haruko does finally get to see Tom, she tries to brush him off and tell him that, you know, I don't love you. But he's like, no, look at me in the eyes and tell me that.
So much good drama. First scene with Haruko where Charles and Heston goes to see her in that prison is my favorite part of the movie. Because it's a really good example of showing and not telling. Though they do a little bit of telling as well. They slowly walk and you see people doing laundry and ironing and cooking. Mm-hmm. Just carrying on as if nothing's wrong.
One thing that stuck out to me there, Zach, was just the giant pile of luggage.
Yeah.
And you can kind of imagine people coming in, having to throw all their luggage in one big pile. They don't know when they're going next. And it's just, it's almost like dehumanizing to have to mix all your luggage together in one giant pile.
Yep.
Yeah. I was about to get to that. Thank you, ZJ. And I wouldn't be too dark. But it did also remind me of the big pile of shoes at the Holocaust Museum. It really did.
No, I don't begrudge you that comparison. It's just, that's wow.
it's a really good scene. It's really interesting.
Yeah.
Because it's based on a true story, the movie doesn't arc back to it like you would in a fictional movie.
Right.
The subtle little things in Tora and Pearl Harbor. I like the reminder that although World War II is as close to a black and white war as you can get in history, it isn't completely.
No, yeah. We also have Captain Garth running into Tom's flight leader in, I think it's probably the same tiki bar, because they only have so many sets.
Strangely, for a movie starring Charlton Heston, this seems like it was really shot on a budget.
maybe it's because of his salary that's why it was shot on a budget.
Yeah, or renting the aircraft carrier for those shots.
That's probably it, actually. Yeah. But yeah, so his Tom's flight leader makes some comments about failure in enemy identification, and Captain Garth, pisses off his flight leader and ends up getting Tom shipped out early on the Yorktown.
By the way, I just gotta say, do you think the Enterprise is a much cooler name than the other carriers? I feel like there's a bit of a gap.
Yorktown's pretty good, I think.
I think Hornet's pretty cool.
Fun fact, before it was gonna be called the Enterprise, Gene Roddenberry, what was his name for the ship?
I mean, I think he had a list of names that were
Yorktown.
In the Yorktown?
not the Farragut?
No. Farragut was Captain Kirk's previous command.
Yeah, he had a bunch of carrier names for the ship on Star Trek, but...
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
One of them was Yorktown. That was one of his... I think it was a second choice, yeah.
Yeah, I would not have liked that.
Speaking of aircraft carrier names, I can't remember if I brought this up during the tour. I probably did. They mention that when asked where the aircraft carrier, where the planes were launched from, Roosevelt says, oh, I can finally reveal to you that they were launched from our base in Shangri-La, which was a reference to the 1938 movie, I think, Lost Horizon, where there's a mythical land somewhere in the East. But that joke stuck with people so much that they actually named an aircraft carrier the Shangri-La later in the war. We built so many aircraft carriers, we named one of them after a joke.
That's pretty good.
I've never heard of that.
Yep. USS Shangri-La.
Wow.
Served all the way through Vietnam, I believe.
Oh, wow. That's pretty good. Make me curious, obviously there's this... I feel like I looked up what the identification code for this Enterprise was.
CV6.
See, I was like, I feel like it's 6, and then I know that the next generation was CVN-65. There is no current USS Enterprise carrier, but there will be. And they're building it now, and it'll be, I think, supposed to be active duty in 2029.
Oh, interesting. They're moving quickly on that one.
I think it's CVN 80. It'll be of Gerald Ford class.
Yep. Interesting to note that in the 4 years of World War II, I believe we built 27 aircraft carriers. And that's about the time period between now and when the when the Enterprise will come online. So it takes us long to build one of them now.
Except as
it
took to build the construction 24. Began in 2017.
Okay, so it takes much longer. It makes it even worse.
It does.
It's much more complicated these days.
We don't have war rationing to, you know, for all of our steel.
Yep.
We go and see Captain Garth going to go see Admiral Pearson in Naval Intelligence. And he tries to, you know, get Haruko and her parents cleared. Apparently they knew each other back in Annapolis. And, you know, he owes him a favor. But now, like, he's like, well, yeah, one, you know, that's a hell of a favor. Two, he is asking a superior officer to circumvent, you know, the rules and the law.
All for his son.
I like how at the end of this scene, he says, all right, I'll look into it. And, like, Garth goes in for the handshake and just, like, looks at him, goes back to his papers.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Like, after this, we're done. We're even. Yeah. Very interesting.
Yeah. On the Yorktown, Captain Garth and Tom finally talk. They clear the air. And, you know, Captain Garth explains that, all right, you know, yeah, I did go to, you know, see Haruko and try to get, you know, something done. I've tried as much as I can, more than I should have. And I was like, okay, thanks for that. But I was like, I didn't tell your flight leader to, you know, to do this, to ship you off, but he thought he was doing us both a favor. And that's where it gets, he's like, it's going so well, and then it just goes downhill for fatherhood. Like, you're supposed to be flying, not crying in your bunk about your girl.
Like, I tried being nice, like, we're a guy.
I was like, oh, you were doing so well, Captain Garth, and then you blew it. You could have had this all go off so smoothly and nicely, but, and you know, you were trying, but then you just blew it. But yeah, so going back to the Japanese, their carriers received word that the recon flight, well, one of their carriers receives word that the recon flight to Pearl Harbor didn't go through. They're all under radio silence, so they can't break radio silence to ask, you know, or tell anyone else.
Yeah, like, do we call it off? What do we do? Nope, yeah, just keep going.
So they've just got to assume that the American carriers are still at Pearl Harbor.
And I don't have a spy fiction here, but I have a spy fact, which is, I believe that the ship that was sent to French Frigate Shoals was sent there because they were expecting the Japanese to try and refuel their ship, their planes there. So it was another bit of... I'm fairly sure I didn't double check this, but I think I remember that the Japanese code was decrypted, and this was one of the things that they did to make sure that they couldn't carry that out.
So the Americans send out scout planes. They don't find anything. We also get to see Midway prepping for the invasion.
That's right. This is our first meeting of Strawberry Five.
Yeah.
That's a wild job, is just fly around without any guns. Look for stuff.
And also another guy who, I don't know, this stuck with me maybe a bit more than you, but Major Red Parks. And they're like, where planes are super outdated. And he's like, but we'll at least let them know we were there.
Yeah, so we have, and now the Japanese carriers are stuck in a storm, so they can't see what's going on. But we get the Japanese, I assume, so this is not their, you know, the fleet that's going on, that's going towards Midway. It's a different fleet that's attacking or bombing Dutch Harbor, or otherwise known as the Aleutian Islands. Mm-hmm. They have found the Japanese carriers. They radio Midway, where Rochford is told that he was right, but they're not sure if the ships spotted were the main force or just the precursor. So this is where, yeah, that spy fact versus fiction that you were talking about, ZJ, earlier.
Yep, where wasn't just Nimitz guessing.
Yeah.
He had definite intelligence indicating that this was not the main body.
Yeah, and this is where the movie kind of starts to lose me in terms of, I have trouble following where everybody is. Needed some computer graphics.
I'm glad it wasn't just me. I was wondering if knowing, like, recognizing these planes threw me off more than a layperson to whom a plane would be a plane.
Because
Plane sight.
I had Mr. At least on the Japanese, you know, carriers. I know that Mr. Miyagi is on that one, so that that helps me identify that. All right, I know that Charlton Heston is on the Yorktown. That helps me identify that. Everything else, like, oh, I can't tell which group is which, or of you know which of if the fighter if the planes are fighters or bombers or torpedo planes. Oh boy.
That's fine because they weren't. They were morphing from one to the next and one side to the next. And there was virtually no two scenes in a row that were the same type of aircraft.
All right. Well, I've got like little bullet points here. So Japanese send out recon flights to find the carriers. Americans are sending scouts of their own. The Japanese ready their second wave in case the Americans arrive. So I like the first wave of planes that they sent out to Midway. We hear that they're like the rookie pilots and that they have their, you know, more experienced pilots in reserve.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And just the pawns go first. Don't tell that.
Yeah, I think it was interesting that they were emphasizing just how careful the Japanese were trying to be mm-hmm. with this. Nagumo is saying, all right, like, I think, like, we're supposed to have known that there are no airplanes. We should have heard if there were aircraft carriers around. But just in case we miss them, we're saving half of our strike force, specifically armed, to launch immediately if we spot them. Mm-hmm. And that seems like a pretty intense safety measure, given you have no indication that this might happen. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
Yeah, there's something to be said for playing it too safe, as it turns out.
Yep.
Interesting, right?
And so we have Strawberry 12, another one of the groups of planes, sees the Japanese planes heading towards Midway, but they're not clear in the communication, so there's no one really knows what's going on. We get the battle commencing. The Japanese bombers take out fighters defending Midway. They bomb Midway. There's a great one-wheel landing here. That was nice.
Oh, yeah, I have a B-17, which we hadn't seen prior to this. But, interestingly, I don't think that this was necessarily intended as this, but there were actually B-17s flying out of Midway. B-17, of course, is a large four-engined level bomber. They fly very high up, and they bomb the Japanese from a very high altitude. And to the degree where the Japanese could see them drop their bombs and then turn and avoid where the bombs would land. So,
wow, that is quite high then.
The American bombers reported two aircraft carriers sunk. And in fact, hit nothing.
Oh, no.
Which is a very consistent theme among early American battle reports.
Yes.
Bad intel.
I think it's interesting because, in a way, showing kind of how chaotic and impossible to interpret all of these different signals would be mm-hmm. would maybe make for an interesting film, but that's not what this film was.
No.
Remake of this movie.
One of the Japanese command, Genda, reads a report about Midway. I know he's not playing Mr. Miyagi here, but I just have him in my notes as Miyagi. Miyagi wants to bomb the airstrip. So he has them switch out the torpedoes for bombs.
Remembering that Genda was a main character in Tora Tora Tora, was he the guy who was like in his room surrounded by papers and stuff? Crazily planning the attack, I think.
That sounds familiar. Let's look up Genda as the actual person and see if they have a thing on what he... So he was at Pearl Harbor. Yeah. Yes, Minoru Genda is chosen to mastermind the operation.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's like seeing a returning character in a TV show. But they've been recast and act totally differently.
The Americans are debating when to launch. Spruance wants to launch now. Japanese scout ship 4 spots the American fleet and radios back, and they stop the swap of torpedoes.
It's like, oh god, guys.
And then one of the other flights, which I don't remember which one it was, Waldron, as the flight leader, takes his plane on his own heading, you know, which is not the heading that he was given. He was told to do.
During the actual Battle of Midway, it was more that some of the flights were vectored on the wrong heading. And the pilots or the flight leaders who knew that, some of them essentially disobeyed the directed heading to fly the correct heading that they knew was
which
correct.
Is kind of we're kind of told that about Waldron. He's like, you know, yeah, he knows what he's doing. So
It's like something out of a movie.
Yeah, there's a lot of that.
By the way, do you guys notice how much better dressed the Japanese are than the Americans? The Americans have like the open collar and they always look like sweaty. And the Japanese look really put together. Even after the carrier gets bombed, they still look like they have it together. I thought that was funny.
We didn't really talk about him, but like the sort of seemingly like the star pilot of the Japanese, Tomonaga. Arrives to refuel. Mm-hmm. Also, we didn't talk about like the reason that Mr. Miyagi wanted, and I'm just going to call him that, just because it's Pat Morita, wanted to switch from bombs to torpedoes, is that they didn't bomb the airfield at Midway because these were the rookie pilots who didn't think about doing that.
Yeah, and that's what you get when you send rookie pilots, as it turns out. There's a cool shot where I thought, in my notes it's a zero, but ZJ, maybe it's not, flies really low over Midway Island. I thought they did a good job with that.
Interesting. I do. I don't remember specifically what type of plane it was, though. But they did have a lot of exciting footage during this part. I think that this was a part that they actually filmed for this movie, like all the explosions and stuff. Because you can kind of see that they have that one set, you know, with the tower in the background. And the moment I saw that tower, I knew they were going to have someone fall off it.
Were there supposed to be these, the fighters for the Japanese were supposed to be zeros, right?
I thought so.
That's why I'm asking DJ.
Yes, the Japanese fighters would have been zeros. A lot of the footage from, I believe it would have been the Japanese film that was made, is fantastic. They did a great job with the every type of Japanese plane. It seems very accurate. I think all the markings are very accurate. And then that'll be interspersed with just random other footage that they got from somewhere. So,
what's the name of the Japanese bombers? I can't remember that.
So the U.S. nicknames for them were the Kate, which is the kind of more level bombing slash torpedo bomber.
Yep.
And then the Val, which is a dive bomber.
I would not remember those either.
So I think also around this part is where I definitely got reminded of Tora, Tora, Tora and The Longest Day. Because especially Tora, Tora, Tora. Because like when they're switching, and I understand why they did it, but when they're switching between all the different, you know, squadrons of planes, they like, the big white letters, who is this pilot and all that. It's like, gosh.
Yep, they got to do it. Well, that was actually something that I wish there had been more of. because there are, you know, they highlighted some of the major characters and players. And, you know, there are a lot of people who played very important roles during the Battle of Midway. And I thought that I kind of would rather have seen them write more around those stories rather than, you know, add Charlton Heston bombing them at the end. Yeah. And but it is interesting because I think that this is when the first torpedo bombing squadrons arrive, right?
Yeah. So, well, we got a lot of things going on sort of simultaneously, but we have the American scouts returned. We get the general quarters. We see Tom again, and he launches. We get Waldron's flight finds the Japanese. They go in. This is some good footage here. The Japanese don't have, at least this ship doesn't have fighter coverage. So, but a lot of the planes are taken out. Waldron's hit. A plane releases a torpedo, but it doesn't hit.
Mm-hmm.
What is this note? Pull out. I think it's Waldron or someone. He's shot and he pulls the bullet out of his arm.
What's his name? Sun does that.
Was that? I don't think that was him, but someone does
could
it.
Could have been. Yeah, it might have been.
No, actually, I think this is Edson Gay. That's right. Because I have my next note is he goes down, but the pilot survived. So, yes.
That's right. I'd forgotten about that.
Yeah. And then we get Bombing Squadron 3, headed by Max Leslie. They arm their bombs, but they have to use manual control because the electronic arming isn't working. And this is where we switch between Fighting Squadron 3 and Torpedo Squadron 3 and Bombing Squadron 3. It's like,
Yeah, all sorts of stuff happening.
Yeah.
And no one knows where anyone else in.
So maybe that's why they're doing this, is so we feel as confused as the pilots.
Yeah, so it feels sort of random.
Yeah.
I'm glad I'm not the only one. Just kidding.
But it was my next step. Oh, yeah. So one of those Squadron 3s spots some ships. And then Tom gets shot up, and he's on fire.
This part was crazy, too. I thought he was going to die for sure.
I definitely thought he was. It looked like third-degree burns. It looked bad. And then we have a Japanese scout who sees all of the carriers, but of course his transmitter isn't working.
Yep. Again, it feels like some kind of Hollywood thing, but that is historically what happened.
Wow. Like, my phone's out of batteries. That's why I can't call the police to deal with the serial killer.
Have another squadron leader, McCluskey, who like sees some ships, but you know, I like this. They show is your show not tell, Zach. Well, they show and tell, but they show first that all right, you see his fuel gauge is going wonky, and then his like his backseater is like, oh, no, we got his gun. I assume is a gunner. Got to turn back. So, yeah, I know. And then the Japanese realize that there must be more than one carrier because there's so many ships.
Important detail here is that McCluskey spots a Japanese destroyer, which in the shot there are two ships. So I was like, the Japanese destroyer had attempted to torpedo the USS Nautilus earlier in the day, which had spotted the Japanese, but not had time to radio a report. It did not successfully depth charge them, but it was racing back to the fleet to get back in formation. And McCluskey correctly judged that the Japanese destroyer would be racing back toward their fleet, and so turned to head along the direction the destroyer had been heading. And that was why he found the Japanese fleet.
Interesting. Yeah, we have McCluskey finding the carriers, and they go for bomby runs, and this is where we get three of the carriers on fire.
Okay, so this really confused me.
Okay.
You can help me out. I don't want to say it ruined the movie, but it kind of did.
Really?
So there's a part where the Americans attack.
Yeah.
And get totally destroyed. And one of the Japanese says, these Americans are sacrificing themselves like samurai. Do you guys remember that part?
Yeah.
Yep.
And then later they attack again and they win. And what's the difference? Like, one worked and one didn't.
That's an excellent question. I wish that they'd done a better job of this in the film. So the difference is the torpedo squadrons versus the bombing squadrons.
Ah, yes.
The torpedo squadrons were flying old, outdated by this point planes that were very slow. And the idea with a torpedo attack is you can't actually go too fast because your torpedo will like skip off the water. So you have to go low, you have to go slow, you have to stay on target, and you got to line it up and do a group attack so that, you know, all the torpedoes go forward and they can't dodge all of them. But that requires coming in low. They're supposed to have fighter cover, but they lost their fighters at some point, or the fighters never found them. And so the torpedo bombers actually attack. And this isn't shown in the movie, but bomber planes from Midway as well attack and are just totally cut up because they're flying low. They're flying slow. The Japanese Zeros are above them because, you know, they're covering the carriers, and all the Zeros just dive down and just make mincemeat out of the torpedo bombers. It's a total disaster, and none of them score any hits.
Okay.
Well, yeah.
So,
yeah.
Thank you. So, why does the second one work?
Because they're not torpedoes, they're bombers.
They're dive bombers. The way they attack is they fly high up, spot the aircraft carriers, and then dive straight down onto them. And historically, what happened for at least one of the dive bomber attacks is the Japanese didn't even notice the dive bombers were there until they were already making their attack runs. That, you know, that's kind of because all the fighters had flown down. I think at one point they say in the film, we no longer have any fighter cover, and draw attention to that.
Yeah, I do say that. Yeah.
The dive bombers then are very high up, and no Zeros can fly up that fast to get to them. So the dive bombers attack and drop their bombs and are not attacked at all during their attacks. So that's why they're so effective, is because they're able to, because of the sacrifice of the torpedo bombers, attack totally undefended targets, essentially.
Christian, did you get any of that from the movie?
I got that they were different. Like, one was torpedoes and the other was a dive bomber. And I understood that. I didn't understand the nuance of why it was more successful. I just saw that it was more successful as a dive bomber versus a torpedo.
Yeah.
And retrospect, I can get it. Yeah. Oh, yeah. That would make sense because for the torpedoes, you really got to be low, and then release, as opposed to a dive bomber, where you can come in from up high, and you know you have less of a less of yourself exposed. You know, you've got a smaller target for them to hit when you're coming up that high.
Mm-hmm.
And I realize I'm using hand motions. I'm like, this is a audio medium.
I missed that too. I had the film pulled up, so I didn't see your hand motion.
Yeah. some Japanese fighters find the Americans. I think they follow. I think it's McCluskey or one of the other squadrons follow them back. We see Tom makes it back to back to the Yorktown, but he crashes into the deck. Medics take him out of it. He's still alive though.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and the footage of a plane landing and crashing is actually historical footage.
Ah, that's cool.
It's not the type of plane he was in, but
of course not.
And I have noted down here, you can really tell the music is by John Williams.
Yeah, Japanese trying to mount attack. They hit the deck of one of the carriers. Of course, the Yorktown, which has been, you know, hastily put back together after Coral Sea.
Mm-hmm.
The radio is down. They have to transfer the flag, which led to the question of, for me, like, wait, how are they getting the Admiral off that ship? And then they answered very quickly, the Admiral's barge. I was like, oh, okay. That, I was like, they're not going to send him out on a dinghy to the other ship, so how do they get him out?
They have him swing over like Tarzan.
I wish we had seen the Admiral's barge, because I was curious. It's like, you know, it's like the captain's yacht in, you know, for the Enterprise. Like, we never actually seen it. We just heard it referred to.
The interesting thing is, at least during peacetime, U.S. aircraft carriers will often carry cars, because whenever the Admiral arrives in a port somewhere, he's expected to meet foreign dignitaries, and he can't well rent an Uber. So they bring their cars, and the U.S. Navy drives their cars, you know, wherever they landed.
That's fun.
There's a lot of room, might as well.
We have the Japanese scout plane, whose radio went down, finally returns to the fleet. And so gives his intel.
Just as historically happened. I do have a note from the Japanese attack. I think they essentially only used footage of American carriers the entire time that the Americans were attacking.
That's funny.
So the Americans bombed American aircraft carriers. But somehow, I think that they got footage of a Japanese aircraft carrier being bombed during the Japanese attack sequence on the Americans. So the one piece of footage of a Japanese carrier being bombed they showed during the attack on the American aircraft carriers. So that was when I decided that the person who picked out this stock footage really was not taking any of this seriously. I also have noted that I feel like the way that they cut the battle scenes was just incomprehensible.
Yeah, it was, especially, you know, they're picking from all these sources. I know that they wanted to put real footage in there. They had to find, you know, whatever they could, but still, it was, there were some real cool shots, but a lot of times it was just not very, you know, visual. As a visual medium, it was not visually told well.
No. You were supposed to infer that certain objects carried over momentum between some scenes and not between others.
Yeah. I find out that Tom is going to be okay, and it's just hands are heavily bandaged. And his dad goes to see him, and he asks his dad to bring a picture of him and Haruko ashore. And this is where Captain Garth is told, all right, we have more planes than pilots. You used to be a pilot. Do you mind going? Okay, I guess so. You know, even though when was the last time he logged any flight hours? Who knows? In what kind of plane was he rated in? Who knows? But I'm going to fly this plane.
Yeah, it seemed a bit far-fetched to me.
We needed him to do something action.
So, we go back to Naval Intelligence, I assume at Pearl, where they've confirmed that the three carriers, actually no, it is at Pearl because Rochefort's there, three carriers out of the four are damaged. They could bring the fleet home, but who is this? Who says, I want that fourth carrier?
Nimitz.
There's a line here that the Japanese have 6 fighters and 10 torpedo planes left. Is that out of all of their planes or just from that ship?
Out of all their planes, because they only have one ship left at that point.
Yeah. They had 3 of them.
Right, of course, because they've only got they had 3 carriers and I had 4. Wow. Captain Garth is in a plane. They find the last carrier. There's a torpedo attack incoming.
Mm-hmm.
And here's where I get a flash forward to about, let's see, this is 1976. Said 7 years in the future. Intensify forward firepower. Too late. Where a plane hits the bridge of one. Actually, I don't even remember which side it's on. That's how incomprehensible this part is.
Yeah, it hit the bridge of the Yorktown.
It was the Yorktown. All right. Yeah. So one Japanese plane hits the bridge of the Yorktown, which of course reminded me of Return of the Jedi, where that A-Wing flies into the Super Star Destroyer Executor.
It also hits like below the bridge, so the bridge crew aren't actually all killed in the movie.
Did that actually happen in real life?
No.
Oh.
I know. I believe something like it happened in one of the other naval battles where prior to any kind of official, you know, kamikaze force from the Japanese, a Japanese pilot did steer his plane into a U.S. ship, but I don't remember the exact context, and I don't believe it was here. And I think this is also the point where they give the order to abandon ship because it's listing heavily, just been hit by two torpedoes. The bottom was already had holes in it before they even started this battle, and it just, you know, busted up the plate that they had. But the interesting fact here is that the USS Yorktown the next morning was still afloat.
Wow.
And they put a party of, you know, 175 people on to start damage control efforts, which were largely successful and were righting the ship when the Japanese submarine, a Japanese submarine spotted the aircraft carrier and fired a spread of torpedoes, which hit the destroyer that was alongside, breaking it in half and sinking it in like a minute.
Wow.
And then additionally hit with two torpedoes on the Yorktown, which finally did sink it.
Wow. So that just kept going for a long time there.
Yes, yes. And there were actually two wounded sailors on the Yorktown who had been left for dead, who started firing a machine gun off in the morning to attract people's attention because they'd been left on the ship when everyone left.
Oh, I will say I was a little concerned for Tom because Tom was on the Yorktown.
Yeah, they had some line about transferring him in about 45 minutes. They did
make a lot of drop lines. All right, I assume he got off of it then.
Yeah.
You know, that last Japanese crew or carrier, there was someone in a dive bomber, and of course it's Captain Garth. And he makes the crucial, you know, dive bomb hit and takes out that last carrier. We get Yamamoto being told by his aides, we need to withdraw. And he decides, okay, sure, I need to personally apologize to the Emperor.
Oh boy, has this new giant worked out? I will say, it's very cathartic seeing them hit the carriers. Because you know how expensive they are.
Well, some of those carriers were actually American ones. So
of course. Have Captain Garth returning to, it's not the Yorktown, but one of the other carriers.
Enterprise, I believe.
Is it Enterprise? Okay. He's coming in, but we saw earlier in the scene that one of his ailerons got all shot up, and it is not responding to controls, and he does not make it.
He augers in.
The one part that I remember from the movie.
See the carrier back in Hawaii. We see Tom being carried off the Enterprise. Has anyone told him that his dad's dead?
That's my thought. Unclear.
Yeah, this happened. Also, in my memory, him dying was like the end of the movie.
pretty much.
And then this is also my note is, all right, this is the first time we see, like, you know, locals from Hawaii, like actual people and not just, you know, military folks.
They looked very 1970s to me. It's not clear to me where they got these extras.
No. Obviously, as like you said, this was not filmed in Hawaii. So, of course, they had to make them look like they're in Hawaii by putting them all in aloha attire. I mean, you know, granted, we like our aloha attire in Hawaii, but everyone wouldn't be wearing it. But then we get Rochford talking to, is it Nimitz? Someone.
Yeah. Yes, it would have been Nimitz. Yeah.
I was like, you know, all right, were we better than the Japanese or just luckier? And then we end with the big giant Churchill quote that, like the beginning block of text, went in my eyes and completely out of my brain after I read it.
Yeah. It was, I think, a Churchill quote about the Battle of Midway and how great it was.
Well, yeah. That's and with that, our movie ends.
I did have one final note about Charlton Heston. I guess you guys didn't pick up on this, but he crashes a jet plane. When it cuts back to the crash, it's a crash of a U.S. Navy jet plane from the 50s.
I did not catch that.
No more propeller. That might have been part of his problem. Oh.
I didn't see that.
Oh man, wow, that's great. Shall we move on to our spy fact versus spy fiction?
Yeah,
ZJ, did you have anything else you wanted to talk about for this particular section, or did we?
No, I think I went through mine during the movie. So
I've got very short stuff. I know Zach's got a decent amount, so let me go first. At one point in the movie, they refer to SyncPAC. I was like, what is SyncPAC? SyncPAC, Commander-in-Chief Pacific Fleet Headquarters. So that's Commander-in-Chief CIC or CINC, and then PAC, PAC. Yeah, so that's what that stands for. It's not quite an acronym. They use all of the word in and part of the word Pacific. And none of fleet. The last thing I've got, this movie uses a slur for Japanese people a lot. I went through the script 24 times. They say it in this movie.
Yep. It's incredibly historically accurate.
Pearl Harbor uses it 6 times. Tora 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 uses it 4 times. Windtalkers uses it 10 times. So, of the movies we've covered here on the Spy-Fi Guys that I can think of, this has definitely got the most of it. It's a lot.
It's interesting. More than twice
as much.
Yeah, 24 times. Really? I went through the script. I was like, all right, let me try searching Japanese. Or just the 3 letters, G-A-P. Oh, and they came up with Japanese. Let me add a space after that. Oh, I'm forgetting when they pluralize it. That gave me another 10. I was like, oh my goodness. 24 times. All right, Zach, what do you got?
My research comes from a blog, Michael C. Smith, Puttering in the Study. He says quite a few things about the movie. He says it's fairly accurate. Traxboat was known to the battle by the mid-1970s. He highlights the book Incredible Victory by Walter Lord. So he says there's quite a few accurate things like the Doolittle Raid, Codebreakers, Nimitz's effort to defend Midway. The most obvious is that Charlton Heston's character is fictional, but he approximates the intermediary role of Commander Edwin Layton, Nimitz's intelligence chief, who, against Washington's express directions to the contrary, obtained and relayed the cryptanalysis results directly to Nimitz.
Interesting. Tune in about 2 months' time. We might hear more about Layton.
Yeah, exactly. He wanted to interpret it himself, so he went to go look. So a few other things. In reality, the aircraft never landed on the Yorktown as it was under attack. This was the Charlton Heston's. He was the squadron leader from the Yorktown.
Yeah.
The Yorktown was under attack, so he was redirected to the Enterprise, where less than 2 aircraft that ran out of fuel were shot down while circling and made up half the strike. The film doesn't show the Yorktown being abandoned. It was abandoned and then sunk.
Which ZJ told us about just not too long ago.
Abandoned. Re-unabandoned, re-abandoned, and then sunk.
So next about Rochefort. Yep. He did wear a smoking jacket and carpet slippers.
Oh, yes, I was wondering about that.
Yeah, the movie gives the impression he's just a kind of weird guy, eccentric.
Yeah.
But the reality was he was working long hours on concrete floors in a room that was chilly.
Okay.
It was chilly in order to get the computer equipment operating more efficiently.
Of course.
And by the way, he passed away 1 month after the movie came out.
Really?
Oh, wow. Interesting.
He was certainly scapegoated by the D.C. Naval Intelligence Committee after the battle for being right. King turned down Nimitz's recommendation that he receive a medal for his intel work. He was transferred to command a floating dry dock in San Francisco.
Oof.
He never went to sea again. One interesting note, and this is the last thing I have, Henry Fonda, the actor, worked as an aide for Nimitz briefly at SyncPAC headquarters on Guam from 1944 to 1945.
That's cool.
Yeah. It was not, Fonda recalled, a close relationship, and he assumed Nimitz was irritated at getting a Hollywood star placed on his staff, however briefly. So that was kind of interesting. And then, I think, did we talk about this for Tora Tora Tora? Both Yamamoto and Nimitz were missing fingers. I think we talked about it during Tora Tora Tora.
I don't recall.
Probably.
Yeah. Yamamoto lost 2 during the Battle of Tsushima. Nimitz in a Operation Engine Room tour. So anyway, that's what I have for Spy Fact versus Fiction.
Shall we go through our favorite quotes next?
Yes, yeah, so EJ, as our guest, would you like to go first?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to pick probably one of the biggest quotes in the movie, which is Yamamoto right at the end. Leave that to me. I am the only one who must apologize to His Majesty. I thought it was just cool.
He gets all the big lines at the end. Yeah, Christian, I can go next. So the first time to the Tiki Bar, Charlton Heston says, don't give me any of that racial bigot crap. Is there that part?
Yeah, he said something like, "I'm not a racial bigot" or something. Or is it the line that you transcribed?
I think it was that. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but the context is, I don't have a problem with her being Japanese. I'm just worried about my son. Mm-hmm. You know, what's it going to do to his career? There's a part where someone mentions, I think it's Coral Sea. It says, "What happened at Coral Sea?" And someone says, "We got hurt." I like the subtle ones.
Yeah.
Like there's a part where someone says, or Nimitz says, "Let's get to battle station, signal the Hornet." Like a lot of the chatter, scratch one flat top, any racism, Christian, when someone says, "He'll find the carries, he's part Sioux Indian."
Right.
Yeah. I found it especially funny because, like, how would that help if you're in an airplane?
I don't know. It's unclear.
The pilot was part Sioux Indian, but I don't think it was given as an explanation for why he found the carriers.
No, of course not. It doesn't make any sense. Then my last one, speaking of Star Wars, this running Star Wars, somebody says, "Pipe down and stay off the air until I report contact." Like, cut the chatter, Red 3.
Yeah. All right. So I've got one funny one and one that's actually based on intelligence. So I'll do the funny one first. I think it's from Charlton Heston. It says, 6 months after Pearl Harbor, boy, you've got some lousy sense of timing. When talking about dating a Japanese girl.
Yeah, I remember that one.
And then from Rochford, we've got, you know, "We've cracked Yamamoto's staff level code, but that don't mean we just reel it off word for word like a song. We get a flicker here and a glimmer there. Missing pieces fall into place."
That's total spies.
I did have a second quote.
Go for it.
Was from Halsey. "I can tell you this, Ray. You play it the way you feel it, not the way you think I'd play it. You go to sea, find Yamamoto, and chew his ass."
Yeah, that was great. I like that part where they have the new guy, like, being brought up to run a carrier.
Halsey, who you'd recommend? And he says, "I recommend Fruence." And he just kind of looks at him like, "That's really inconvenient."
I also like, you know, that Halsey's like complaining about the tree blocking his view. And when Spruance comes to see him, like, his last line is like, "I'll get someone to cut down that tree." But the way he says it, it feels like there should be some follow-up that is like, it's like the start of a joke, or that Halsey should have said something in return. But it's just nothing. It just ends with that.
You know, I think that's very similar to what we saw in Tora Tora Tora, where it's something that happened. And so it just feels so out of place when it's in the film.
That's right. Yeah, there's like, you know, they have to include the things that actually happened, but it just feels so random.
No narrative purpose to it.
Yeah.
So maybe to establish that Halsey's kind of a impetuous, needs to see everything that's going on.
Yeah.
It's only got a little too real all of a sudden.
Alrighty, shall we go on to our ratings?
Yeah, so here on the Spotify Guys, we do ratings on a scale of 1 to 10 martinis, 1 being Avengers 1998, and 10 being even better than No Time to Die or Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. So how would we rate Midway, the old one, 1976? ZJ, as our guest, would you like to go first?
Sure. I think I'd give it a 4. I was not a fan of this movie. Maybe I'm just not a Charlton Heston fan. And there was a lot of Charlton Heston. I do think that narratively it structured things to make more sense, but then I really resented that the actual battle sequences were just a total hodgepodge of random stuff that they put together.
All right. Interesting. Zach?
So, yeah, I also didn't think the movie on the whole was that good. The part with the girlfriend was super interesting, and the battle scenes were exciting. Like, when they hit the carriers, I was like, wow. But it doesn't save the movie. I really enjoyed Tora, Tora, Tora because I could tell what was happening. And I thought they handled it very well. This movie, not so much. I've seen better World War II movies, better ones from the 70s. So I'm going to give it a 5 out of 10. It is okay.
Yeah.
Perfectly okay.
All right. I'm wondering. I'm wavering about where I think I was initially considering a 6. I think I'll bring it down to a 5.5. It was fine. I mean, there are parts, not knowing about Midway at all, other than what I learned at the National Cryptologic Museum, gave me an overview of what happened there. It is more of like a history. Well, love story aside, which is just giving you a flavor of the times of what was going on. It's almost like it's a history book, which is also how I felt about The Longest Day or Tora Tora Tora, and even a bridge too far. It's telling a story that happened, but not doing it in a real narrative way. It's just, all right, these are the events that happened. And yeah, it was fine. Actually, now I'm kind of curious, what did I give all those other things I just talked about? Bridge too far, I said 7. Tora, 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 I said 6. And what was the other one? Oh, yes. The Longest Day, I said... Where'd it go? When did we do The Longest Day?
Relatively recently.
I think it was further back at you than we think it was. Anyways, I feel like... Oh, here it is. I get a 5. So yes, would I rate this higher than The Longest Day? Interesting, interesting.
I definitely would not. I thought The Longest Day was pretty good.
All right, I am bringing it down to a 5 then. So at least it's at the same level. Longest Day was fine. It wasn't a good spy movie. This at least had more actual spy action, but the movie on the whole was not as good. Yeah, I'm there with you, Zach, at a 5. I'm very curious to see what we will think of, 2019's Midway when we come back in 2 months' time. Because it is, I think, no spoilers here, but I think it is more structured, as a 2019 movie and in a narrative way. And it kind of has to be, because that's how audiences like their films nowadays. So we will see. We will see what. And so, ZJ, do you have anything you want to promote?
Nope.
All right. Well, thank you all for joining us. Like we said, in 2 weeks' time, or sorry, 2 months' time, we'll be back with our part two of this duology with ZJ. For 2019's Midway, and in between we'll have one of our spy fiction films, TBD on what that will be. You'll find out once you see it pop up in your feeds. You can find us on social media at the Spy Fi Guys on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, as well as on YouTube, and you can find our merch store on redbubble.com. Until next time, I'm Christian.
And I'm Zach.
We are the Spy Fi Guys, signing off.
Thank you for listening to the Spy-Fi Guys. If you enjoyed our podcast, please be sure to give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. The theme song from this podcast is Mistake the Getaway by Kevin MacLeod from Incompetech.com. Licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0. Films, books, and television shows reviewed by our podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended.
This is a personal podcast. Any views, statements, or opinions expressed in this podcast are personal and belong solely to the participants. They do not represent those of people, institutions, or organizations that the participants may or may not be associated with in a professional or personal capacity unless explicitly stated. Any views or opinions are not intended to malign any religion, ethnic group, club, organization, company, or individual.
You can find our podcast on social media at The Spy-Fi Guys. On Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.